The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the MadTech Podcast. Today, we've got another team episode. I'm Amy, and I'm also here with ExchangeWire CEO Rachel Smith. Thanks for joining us, Rachel.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, all the way from Australia.
Indeed. Yep. So, you know, middle of the night for me. Not quite, bit of an exaggeration.
Yeah, it's great to have you with us. And Lindsay Rowntree, our COO. Welcome, Lindsay.
Hello. Lovely to be here. And probably, well, definitely my last podcast for a number of months. So
that is true.
Yeah.
Lindsay's about to go and have a baby, which is super exciting. But I think at ExchangeWire, all of us are just totally obsessed with how much we're going to miss you. So, yeah.
Yeah, you'll be very
I'll
missed.
I'll miss you all too.
Oh, you won't.
Yeah. You'll be very missed.
I will miss you, but I'll also be very distracted. So
You will. Yeah. You'll be kept very busy. And I'm sure the listeners are going to miss you too, Lindsay. So that's something to look forward to, listeners, in what have we decided, Lindsay? About 3 or 4 weeks' time, are we coming back?
Yeah, 3 or 4 weeks, what you said. And then I can bring the baby into the office. That's what we decided, wasn't it?
That's it.
Great. Thanks.
So today we're discussing Sky News' decision to overhaul its newsroom in favor of paid content, OpenAI's accusation against DeepSeek, and Nielsen ending its panel-only ratings. So our first story today is from the FT. Sky News has announced plans to overhaul its programming and newsroom to create more premium paid content to protect its future amidst the decline of linear TV. Through a new strategy named Sky News 2030, the broadcaster aims to reshape its digital focus service over the next 5 years to attract consumers who are willing to pay for news. So, Rachel, how will this move impact the publishing landscape? What do you think about this?
So, firstly, I think it's a super interesting move from Sky. It's absolutely, I think, the right strategy for a traditional TV news broadcaster, because we all know that consumption habits have changed so significantly, even in the last 4 to 5 years, that the likelihood of people consuming Sky News in the way that they did, you know, sort of 15, 20 years ago is very low. No doubt people still consume Sky News and probably still consume it in a TV style environment. But I just think that the appetite for consuming 24/7 news, for consuming the type of news perhaps that Sky produces has really gotten quite mixed up with the, you know, with the proliferation of news-related content available via social media platforms, and also with, I think, challenger news brands as well. So I think that this is a really good move from Sky. They were going to be forced into a position where they had to, if you like, modernize their news service. I think what's really interesting about this is that I feel as though they're moving to a traditional media model. When I say traditional, I just mean mixed revenues. You know, for a long time, Sky's been able to dine off, I suppose, you know, a classic kind of cable TV style monetization model, supplemented with advertising. Of course, once they were acquired as well by Comcast? I'm now going to get that wrong. Was it Comcast? Yes, it was Comcast.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Back in 2018, that sort of secured their funding position, since Comcast promised to make sure that they continued to guarantee Sky News funding for an additional 10 years. That kind of guaranteed their funding position. But I think, therefore, that they were always going to have their hand forced at some stage in the game to rethink their monetization model. So the move to what I would describe as more of a traditional media model. Of course, it's not traditionally how news media outlets make money. This is much more of a mixed monetization model, where they've said they're going to launch a subscription service. They're going to rely much more heavily on creating new and original podcast content, for which they're expecting some subscribers, no doubt. Newsletter style content, again, trying to attract some subscriptions, and live events. And so they're very clearly moving away from their live news, 24/7 sort of streamed news model into something that's much more nuanced and specific, and requiring some kind of sign-in and some kind of customer brand loyalty, people wanting to actually consume the type of news that they're putting out. So I think that's a real shift for Sky News as an entity and as a brand, but I think it's really smart because I don't think that there was going to be a huge, there certainly wasn't going to be guaranteed funding arrangement in their existing model. They've already stated, the FT article went into a bit of detail about how their current funding model wasn't really growing revenues, so it was stagnating. And you can only imagine that when Comcast came to look at whether they would renew that funding position in, you know, 2028, that Sky News would have been looking like they were on fairly shaky ground from a revenue perspective. So they've definitely got to do something to mix things up. And I think this is a smart path. I think the bigger question, though, is whether it's a bit too late in the game, whether they needed to make some of these big, bold moves a little sooner. And in fact, some might argue they're not very bold moves. They're actually just sort of slightly nuanced. But I still think it's a really important and interesting move. And I suppose, you know, on a personal note, I hope that it might create a Sky News service that's a little bit less tabloid and a little more considered. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, they definitely need to change with the changing consumer habits. Just on that note, what you said there, Rachel, Lindsay, do you think it's too late?
I do see Rachel's point about it being too late. I think it's an interesting one. They, I'm not saying they've maybe kind of shut the stable door off, the horse has bolted, but they are, they're trying to revolutionise something that kind of, I guess, other broadcasters have been sort of looking to do for a while. It's interesting the route they've gone down. Given how much, as a general broadcaster, Sky have done in other areas to try to monetize their content, it's interesting that the news kind of aspect of what they do has been left for quite a while. I feel like a lot of that was because they were getting a lot of funding from Comcast this whole time. That funding will end in a couple of years. I think it ends in 2028. So that's forcing them to kind of look at and revisit, okay, well, come that time, we're not going to get any funding from Comcast to cover our news broadcast channel anymore. What do we do instead? Oh, crap, we better make some moves. And it might be that they are looking at this in the wrong direction. I think that what interests me, and actually the kind of whole linear broadcast versus digital was a good chat we had with Charlie Glynn from Channel 4 on the podcast, which is an episode worth listening to because she's got some really interesting insights about kind of how that plays out. And as Rachel said, this is a it's just an evolution of revenue monetization. It's you know, we all have to work out where revenue is going to come from. We all have to accept change. It's not a loss necessarily. Linear is doing what linear is doing, digital is doing, and streaming is doing what streaming is doing. And if you can make sure you embrace that, then that makes a lot of sense. I'm a bit ignorant in terms of paying for premium news when it comes to viewing it on TV. I don't really know like where you would go to find paid for news versus non-paid for news. I don't really know much about those kind of channels because I don't really consume much TV news. But if you look at how news is consumed from a viewer perspective on your phone or kind of in a newspaper, we've seen such a seismic shift in that, as a seismic shift in how publishers are kind of generating revenue and having to kind of like have, as Rachel said, mixed media models. It stands to reason that they have to do the same thing in broadcast TV as well, as linear is changing so much, and you know, much more slowly than maybe it happened with newspapers, but it is changing a lot. I don't know how many people still watch like the live 6 o'clock news on BBC or ITV in the UK. I imagine that's also been in sort of sharp decline over the years. But I think if you look outside of news and just look more generally, I consume quite a lot of cycling content on Eurosport in the UK. And Warner Brothers Discovery, who own Eurosport, are getting rid of the channel entirely. They're getting rid of Eurosport 1, Eurosport 2, moving everything to their paid-for platform, which is TNT Sports, which you can't watch that for free anymore. You can watch it for free on DMAX instead. And if you want to watch any live cycling, you have to pay £31 a month, which is, you know, to go from zero to £31 a month is a lot of money. But there'll be enough people out there, not me, but I might do during like a grand tour, but enough people out there that will do that. I think that, you know, we're having to accept that is the route that these broadcasters are going down, because they need to try to combat the maybe loss of ad revenue from linear channels, and they aren't quite sure how to properly monetize their paid for channels yet. So they're going down the subscription route. It does beg the question, we talked a long time about, you know, kind of fatigue when it comes to subscriptions, and just another one, especially when it's so expensive. I mean, all the sports packages are expensive anyway. But it does beg the question about what fatigue looks like. And again, I wish I knew more about how news in a TV environment is consumed to understand kind of what sort of people would pay for Sky News. I'm really not sure who would, but I think that they obviously believe that enough people would to make this a viable option for them.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess one of the things is that they are, so they're talking about how they're trying to shift the model from less paid for content and more live content to more paid for content and less live content. So I think the question that you've asked there, Lindsay, around, I'm interested to know who is consuming live broadcast TV news, is a really interesting one, because either Sky are aware of the fact that those consumer numbers have fallen significantly, and you know that might be the case, it might not be the case, we don't know, they haven't disclosed it. But let's imagine that that is the case, then that's telling them that there either isn't an audience there for that type of news content at all anymore, or that audience is going to be found elsewhere. So they might still service them with some free-to-air type of live news, but it's probably not going to be on a broadcast TV channel. Maybe it's going to be, you know, snippets, more snackable-sized, bite-sized content on a social media platform. And maybe it's going to be distinctly different type of, you know, news bulletin to the ones that have sustained them as a news brand until now. So I'm also wondering if it's going to be one of those revolutionary moments in time, which is what 24/7 news was when Sky first came to our TV, to our TV sets, which is what they were back in the day. That was revolutionary then, right? You know, this whole idea that you could have this 24/7 news channel that was just constantly funneling mostly unimportant information to you. So are we seeing now another revolutionary shift where they've worked out that there's not enough money in sustaining that business, that live business, and the viewership for that kind of live TV bulletin is such that actually they'll take their chances and they'll make that content available free elsewhere but in a completely different environment? Or like you said, Lindsay, maybe they're just going to bet hard on being able to provide some kind of niche content that people are going to be willing to pay for. I don't know. In that sense, it sounds like a bit of an experiment, right? But, you know, they've got to do something. So
they do. It's interesting, like you, the comment I think Amy made about kind of, will they make it less, you know, cause Sky, I think, can be seen as a bit tabloidy in terms of the news aspect versus, say, going to BBC News 24, for example, which has a more world focus. Like, are they going to get rid of the likes of Kay Burley, who is considered, they'd definitely be considered a kind of a tabloidy presenter, or is she the kind of person that people would pay to watch and pay to see? And that, I think that's interesting, as you say, like, will they go down the niche route and go, right, you can pay to access this kind of news? Otherwise, if they're just producing the same kind of news that's being pumped out as BBC News 24, what is the actual point?
Quite, because those consumers are just going to go to BBC News 24. But actually, if it's that people want to see maybe controversial pundits, maybe tabloid journalism, you know, maybe something a bit more strongly opinionated or potentially salacious, do they take that to other platforms? And then how do they monetize that? Is it via a subscription model, or is it social media heavily subsidized by ads and it's just a different, and, you know, arguably if it's only accessible via that social media platform, then maybe they've got more of a scale proposition there. I don't know, but they're clearly looking at really mixing things up, and now is the time to do this. You know, in answer to your original question, Amy, what's it going to do to the publishing industry? It's going to be a great experiment for everybody to watch and see, is this possible? What does it look like? And if they are groundbreaking, which they stand a chance of being, then we could start to see other broadcast news channels following suit.
Yeah. Yeah, so that leads me on to the next question I was going to ask, of just looking at the wider picture. Do you think we're going to see more publishers, more broadcasters doing the same, moving towards models which prioritise paid content?
I would say we kind of are already seeing it, really. I mean, the BBC, obviously in this country, aren't allowed to do that, but they certainly can and are in the likes of the US. We're seeing Netflix obviously go into live streaming. And side note, I didn't realise that obviously in this country, if you view anything live, you need a licence, you need to pay a TV licence. So
there we go, TV licence people, pop round to Lindsay's house.
I don't watch the BBC, to be fair, I do actually pay for one. I don't watch the BBC, so I need one. But if you're watching any live content on Netflix or Amazon Prime, you need one. Wow, yeah. Didn't know that. Anyway, so that's going to cause
I didn't know that either.
No, that will cause some students some problems
there
in this country.
UK TV licensing, ka-ching, ka-ching.
Yeah, exactly. But if you if you look at the likes of the ITV Hub and the Channel 4 streaming service as well, they've gone down that route very heavily. They've invested heavily into their you know, I'd say BVOD services, but you know, ITV would certainly say this is, we're not a B, like ITV Hub is not a BVOD service, it's a streaming platform where you know, they've got the ad funded model, they've got good sponsorship deals, and they also have the monthly subscription or annual subscription. So they've definitely gone down the mixed media route already. Sky obviously also have done in terms of how you access Sky or how you access Now TV and the different packages that are available there. So bringing the news aspect into that, I guess, makes an interesting lot of sense, because again, I'm a Sky customer and have been for so long. I don't know how else you access Sky News. I'm assuming nobody else can unless they're a Sky customer or a Now TV customer, in which case I'm already paying for Sky News. So yep. Why would I pay extra for additional content when I haven't got to do that anywhere else, apart from maybe movies and sports? If I want to get a movie early that's just come out the cinema, I wouldn't do that in a news context. So I'm not sure how that would work. And that would be interesting to see.
And I mean, I guess that's where maybe specialist content comes in, right? Like you'll pay for it because there's a podcast series or something that you want to access as well. And maybe it's bundled in. And that's where I think things could get interesting, because maybe Sky will go back to an entertainment, you know, considering themselves as an entertainment channel, not just a news broadcaster. And what does that do to their content platform? And then picking up on your question there, Amy, which, you know, which Lindsay, I think, gave a good answer to, does it impact, you know, would it influence other publishers to move towards more paid for types of content? I think publishers are in a position where they feel as though that there's almost no choice. They have to experiment with that. They've got to protect as much revenue as possible. Advertising isn't going to achieve everything that they need to achieve. And I think they want to find a way to protect the integrity and the originality of their content. And the only way to do that is to attach a price tag to it, I think. So I think lots of publishers will head down that same route.
Yeah, lots of publishers. I mean, yeah, it's difficult for all publishers really at the moment. So it'll be interesting to see how Sky navigates this move. So now on to our second story. Also from the FT, which looks at a bit of a tables turning moment for OpenAI. The AI company says it's found evidence that Chinese AI startup DeepSeek used its proprietary models to train its own open source competitor. And now OpenAI is concerned about a potential breach of intellectual property. Rachel, considering the lawsuits against OpenAI accusing it of illegally training its AI models on publishers' written content, do you think this accusation is too ironic to take seriously?
I mean, that's a really good question, right? Because it feels as though this is the only story that everyone's talking about this week, right? So all eyes are on DeepSeek. Most people probably hadn't heard of it until this week. And it's making us think about intellectual property rights and the integrity of how these AI models are trained. So in answer to your question, it's definitely a bit rich. Because there's a lawsuit underway against OpenAI involving some major US publishers who are making substantiated claims that OpenAI have illegally used their content to train its model. So it is really interesting that the same allegations are now being put forward to DeepSeek. And I feel like it's another one of those China versus the US moments where the reason that this is such a big story is because this AI model is not just a competitor to the AI models, incumbent AI models in the US that are being developed at pace and are well funded, but it's also a Chinese competitor, right? So, you know, it's hard reading the press in Western countries that is very US-centric. It's hard to know who has undertaken the bigger infringement here, whether it is DeepSeek or whether it's OpenAI pertaining to, you know, homegrown publishers. But I think the thing that this story is reminding us is that AI models are accelerating so quickly at the moment, and they are doing exactly what they were promised to do a couple of years ago when we all first started using ChatGPT, which was get smarter and faster the more content that they can ingest and the more varied that content can be. So I think there was probably always going to – a moment was always going to arrive when one model was outpacing the other off the back of learning from that very model. How is that not going to happen at some stage? Yeah, as to where this goes, I think it's actually going to start to become a politically motivated debate. It will, I think, usefully focus all eyes on how we protect intellectual property rights, because actually I'm less concerned about what that means for the health and growth of companies like OpenAI in the first instance. That's important, of course, but I'm less worried about that in the first instance and more worried about what it's doing to publishers. So I think this is just underscoring the reason that that current lawsuit against OpenAI is so important, and we're all going to need to have a grown-up conversation about how we regulate AI and the use of content to train AI models and to do other stuff with it, quite frankly.
Yeah, that's a good point. Hopefully we'll bring the attention back to that, which seems to be the more important issue here, really. What do you think, Lindsay?
I totally agree with Rachel. Actually, I'm interested, Rachel, given where you are in the world right now, talking about Western media and how they're kind of, it's all very US-centric, are you seeing different perspectives? Are you seeing like a more kind of Asian-focused perspective, or is it everyone kind of going, oh my God, like, is it, because there's almost like a mass hysteria around DeepSeek and a mass panic in this part of the world. Is the same feeling over in Australia as well?
100%. I mean, perhaps not the same feeling amongst people, but if you read the media, 100%. I mean, don't forget, you know, sometimes Australia is referred to as as the 51st state of the US. Very Americanized, but also in general very Westernized, and have the same sort of fear of the Chinese in a political sense as the US does. So no, we're not really getting a different opinion reflected to us. Obviously, we've got a few different media outlets, as we do in the UK as well. There's The Guardian Australia, and there's a few alternative media outlets that are trying to take a position, or not even necessarily take a position, but just flush the debate out a little bit. But I think anyone that knows anything much about the way AI tools are being developed and refined won't even find this that surprising. It's no surprise at all that the Chinese are advancing their own AI models just as fast, if not faster, than we are, or than the Western countries are. And so, no, we're not really getting much of an Asian perspective on it, even on the day after Chinese New Year. No, we're not really getting any Asian media here. So it'd be really interesting, and it'd be interesting to see what the media and the press are saying in places like Singapore, which of course is also very Westernized for an Asian country, but is also very China sympathetic and has a controlled media. So it'd be really interesting to hear what kind of news reports they're getting out of there.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see. Yeah. And there is, I mean, there's also, a lawsuit going on from Indian news publishers against OpenAI and Canadian. So it's, they've got themselves into problems with publishers in the whole world.
They have, but I think honestly, they're probably carrying on regardless, and they'll be good luck to OpenAI to OpenAI if they intend to try to take DeepSeek to court, because that's going to be fun. It's going to take years. Going to be so expensive, so messy, so much litigation, so much back and forth. In the meantime, if DeepSeek have indeed used OpenAI to help build and train their model, which, let's be honest, they probably have done, because if you are the trailblazer, this is the price you pay, which is what, you know, the stock situation that OpenAI is in. Yeah. They'll just keep probably using OpenAI to build their model and train their model, because I've got no doubt that OpenAI, among all these lawsuits that are against them, and there are many, are doing the same thing. Like, we, you know, there's no evidence to suggest that they sort of said, right, whatever your accusers are doing, we're not doing it, or we're going to stop doing it. They need to continue doing it, because that is the very basis of how ChatGPT has been created, how it's been developed, and the whole argument around reimbursing publishers. I mean, you've got to love a bit of irony, haven't you? It's like, it will just be another lawsuit that will just, everything will carry on in the background while the kind of the lawsuit kind of rages on. And it will take, especially as it's cross-border, it will take God knows how many years for anything to come to fruition, if it even does. And you know, what's going to happen to the likes of AI more generally. Yeah, exactly.
May as well just get on with continuing to develop your own AI tool, right? Like that's going to be the most important thing. I think the other thing, though, is that connected to the first story, I wonder if this landscape where we're, you know, we're literally the global story of the week is about this Chinese AI tool that's very similar to ChatGPT, stealing information from ChatGPT and other open AI platforms and improving themselves. I wonder if that's actually going to put consumers in a mindset where they are starting to feel like they should pay for content, because that will be one way to verify that that content is coming from reliable and trusted sources. We might be coming to, I'm probably being a bit Pollyanna here, but we might be coming to a period in time where people are thinking, for God's sakes, everyone that's got hold of information, I'm using air quotes here because that the breadth of that is massive, and that can do something with it, could be using it for good, for bad, could be using it for political motivations. Who's got control of that? Who can regulate that? How do we know that what we're reading is factually correct? Well, I need to, you know, I would feel better about it if I was actually contributing financially to something that is, you know, that verifies that information. And maybe we will move to a world where people will understand that we need to pay for some of this content. That's part of where all of this controversy is coming from. It's not just about the pace of the development. One of the reasons that the pace of development is so important is because those AI tools need to monetize themselves as quickly as possible. And the way they think they're going to do it is get to more and better information faster and more people using them. So I wonder if there is a unintended consequence that could actually be welcome for the publishing industry, which is how about we start paying for content and then see where we get it from?
I think that's a really good point, actually, because as the younger generations are growing up, almost embroiled in all this litigation, all these different kind of new platforms coming out, you know, the social media platforms, the kind of the open AI, how they're all being used, how they're being monetized, with publishers, you know, being very open and honest and vocal about how they're struggling and how they need to try to change the way that they are monetizing because consumption's changed so much. Hopefully, I mean, for the old generations, you know, kind of sort of my parents' age and above, they won't get that because they've had free media forever. You know, arguably our generation's had free media forever as well. And we are just learning to understand the value exchange that we are getting and starting to pay for stuff. The younger generations, hopefully it'll become a bit more second nature to them. That they'll sort of go, okay, I get this. I get what I'm getting for this. And I get how publishers are struggling because they've been so honest and vocal about it. And they're growing up in a world where it becomes quite sort of second nature, that maybe that understanding will be there for future generations to come. And that'll make it very interesting.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see what effect this has, really. So let's move on to our last story now, which is from the Wall Street Journal. Media measurement firm Nielsen has announced it will be terminating its consumer panel-based TV ratings, a product which has served as the standard for measuring US TV ratings for decades. Once the product becomes unavailable in the final quarter of the year, Nielsen wants customers to use its newer ratings product called Big Data Plus Panel, which combines panel-based consumer data with numbers drawn from third-party vendors like smart TV manufacturers. Nielsen has been trying to move its customers to this new product for several years, but received a bit of pushback when doing so. So Rachel, what impact will this have on players in the ad tech ecosystem, this change of getting rid of this panel-based TV ratings and moving to the newer version?
So I think, you know, panel-based TV ratings, there's been lots of debate about the effectiveness, verifiable nature of panel-based TV ratings as a measurement tool for a long time. And I think lots of people in the industry have thought that they're rubbish, and lots of people think that they're really useful because they were a standard and the only standard that existed. I think there's a couple of issues here. The first is that there are and have been competitors to Nielsen in their panel-based measurement tool. And those competitors, I think, have been starting to develop slightly more nuanced measurement approaches, which also include data, user data from TVs. And so effectively, that's what Nielsen is moving to, a new version that's actually going to have some data available from smart TV manufacturers. I think that's only going to be a good thing, more useful than the current panel-based measurement tool. It was flawed, and I think there was certainly an argument to suggest we needed to take it seriously for a long time because it was one of the only things that we had. But I do think that this new model that they're putting forward is going to be more usable and more therefore more useful. As to whether, like I said, they've got some competitors in the market, right? And I think the real problem here is that there's a lack of standardization, exactly who is measuring what, and no doubt those different measurement platforms aren't going to come up with the same results. So as a brand or a marketer who wants to understand what's happened with their investment, you're going to have to decide who you're going to listen to. And I guess that will depend on where you're running your campaigns and what measurement tool is available, depending on where you're running those campaigns. So I think it is a good thing in general, though, for TV, because, come on, we live in a digital TV world now, so I think panel-based measurement only doesn't make sense. You need something that's far more data-oriented. It's certainly the case that we can produce a lot more data, so we should be looking at it. I also have been thinking that it will be hopefully a good thing because it will bring to the table other broadcasters and TV streaming providers. It will bring them to the table and put a bit of pressure on them to provide more data too. I think there's been bits and pieces of criticism levelled at Netflix, perhaps even Amazon as well, about the amount of data that they make available to brands and advertisers who run campaigns on their platforms. And I think that maybe moving to panel-based measurement with, TV manufacturer, smart TV manufacturer data will help to level that playing field a little bit and bring those other players to the table to be a bit more transparent. I'm not saying, outright that the way that Netflix and Amazon are currently measuring engagement on their platforms is wrong by any stretch. I think that they're probably trying to implement measurement tools that make sense. But I think we need to start to come to an agreed view of what is good measurement in a TV environment. And maybe this will help us get there, or at least bring some of those people to the table to have more of a holistic debate. At the moment, for example, I'm, a roundabout way of saying that the likes of Netflix in particular are no longer showing us what their streaming numbers are. They're no longer reporting growth associated to that in the same way that they used to. I think that's fine, except when it comes to advertising investment. I think advertisers deserve to have as much data as possible fed back to them about what's happening with that investment and what kind of engagement they're getting. And so some of the measurement tools that Netflix are trialing and putting forward, amount of time spent engaging with streaming platform, is going to be really useful. So hopefully this new Nielsen product is taking us much more to that end and away from pure panel-based data.
Yeah, hopefully it will lead us in a good direction. What do you think, Lindsay?
I think that it is a necessary change, and Nielsen have been needing to, I guess, get with the times for a while. That the challenge you have with being the kind of legacy measurement provider is that everyone gets so used to you and what you provide that when you do try and make changes, it can backfire, and those changes need to be made. But the problem that they're going to have with all of their partners is that those partners don't like change, and a lot of change needs to happen from their side. When Nielsen changed their measurements data, it means that they'll have to kind of go and change their pricing models, go and change how they kind of bill clients, go and change how they plan, how they buy. If you're an agency, it kind of makes things very, very complicated. And I think there was in the WSJ article that that this came from, I think something like 64% of buyers used other measurement tools outside of Nielsen in 2024. They may well have used Nielsen as well. And I think that if you can afford to do that, and it's very expensive to use multiple different sources of data to be able to plan your measurement, is great. Now, the beauty of what Nielsen are providing is that they are providing all in one place. And certainly if you work for an agency, you want everything in one place. It makes life much, much easier. You can't necessarily afford to be investing in multiple different platforms, but there are lots of different platforms out there, and even Disney. And we talked again with Charlie Glynn 2 weeks ago about Disney and how Disney does their measurements. And they have a completely sort of a different model to how we might see other platforms do it. If you are happy to use all these different tools to bring everything together and kind of, I guess, mash them together yourself in-house, then great. If that's what works for you, but it will make it easier for everything to come together in one place. But as it's such a big amount of change, Nielsen are going to struggle. And I think that they're going to need to accept that there are other measurement providers out there. Disney, for example, are using different measurement providers and Nielsen is not one of them. They need to be able to embrace that. But the change does need to happen, and the change has arguably happened a bit too late for Nielsen, hence why these other providers have been able to actually kind of go out there and get some decent market share. And now these other providers are being used, everyone's probably going to kind of go, well, why would I need to enhance my usage of Nielsen? I use Nielsen for panel-based stuff, and I use these providers for all the digital stuff. Why would I go back and use Nielsen for all of that? Can I trust what Nielsen's providing me? Does the Nielsen data match up with what I'm seeing from other providers? And there's so many different things to think about, so many different moving parts to trying to measure the effectiveness and measure the reach of a TV ad. It kind of becomes not worth it. I think Nielsen are going to struggle, and maybe because they first announced this, you know, sort of 4 or 5 years ago, I think. It's been a long time coming. They're probably going to struggle to get people to make the change now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point, Lindsay, because also there is, you know, the cost of using more than one tool to, you know, to measure and to verify. That's going to really put a lot of brands and a lot of agencies off. And if Nielsen are too behind in this race, like you said, others are just going to be at the forefront of people's minds. And I think one of the other criticisms that have been levelled towards Nielsen too is that having tried to make changes before in the past, they weren't substantial enough. And so therefore, you know, their customers might just not read this as a big enough change. They might think, oh, this again. Haven't you been talking about doing this for years? Anyway, I'll just get on with with using the tools that I'm currently using. So, you know, you're right. Maybe it's too late for Nielsen. Time will tell.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see what it does with the competition there, how it affects the landscape. Very well, I think that's a good note to finish on. So thanks both for joining us for today's episode. Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks, Amy. It was great to be on the podcast again.
And thanks, Lindsay. Hope you enjoyed your last podcast in a very long time.
Thank you. It feels very, very strange, but I'll see you all again in a few months.
Yeah.
And thanks very much to all our listeners. That was today's Mad Tech Podcast.